Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Lee Gordon, the founder of the remarkable Arab-Israeli hand-in-hand schools in Israel. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We are now just 2 weeks away from Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. The great beauty of the Jewish High Holy Day season is the wonderful opportunity it provides each of us to start over. Whatever it is that we've done in the past year, whoever we've offended, however we've failed, we now have the chance to begin again, to remake our personal world. The Hebrew word tshuva means more than repentance. It means return as well, to the best that is within us. In the course of a long year, even the most ethical of us have been known to act in ways that are less than stellar, to do things we're not proud of having done. In a basic human way, the High Holy Days ask us to remove the burden of guilt, that most Jewish of emotions, and restore the delicate balance we all need in our lives. By repairing our relations with others, we can reignite the divine spark within us and return to being the good people we wish to be. If we are fortunate and sincere in our tshuva, we can even rediscover the idealism that we've hidden away so deeply under the weight of daily responsibilities and emotional baggage. And we can emerge from this period of the year refreshed, replenished, ready to live better lives in the new 5773 year. What a gift. But first, we must admit that we made some mistakes. In this season of Eight Ratzon, this time of potential divine favor, it's essential for us to look as well at our Jewish community. In order to make tshuva effective, we must honestly examine both our individual actions and the ways we have worked collectively. In the past year, have we really done all we could to improve our microcosm of the Jewish world? Or are we simply perpetuating the same mistakes annually? The Hebrew word for year, shana, comes from the same root word as the Hebrew word for change, mishaneh. The lesson is clear. Where we have not succeeded, we must seek new ways to do things. Where we are not meeting our goals and ideals, we must change. Unfortunately, in our communal Jewish world, we are not meeting our goals. We need to change. Last week here on Two Jewish, we interviewed the head of the Los Angeles Jewish Federation, Jay Sanderson. He comes from an entrepreneurial business world rather than the more typical Jewish organizational background of so many Jewish community professionals. Tracing the demographics of the American Jewish community, Jay believes that the non-Orthodox aspects of our society will simply disappear in the next 25 years without significant change in what we are doing now. That is the severe decree he sees in this season of judgment. I am not quite so pessimistic, but I do believe that far too much of our energy, talent, attention, and resources go in the wrong direction. Without a significant redirection, we will see the great American Jewish community of the 20th and 21st centuries fade in numbers, relevance, and importance. While this may come as news to some, the essential elements of Judaism are not greeting, meeting, and eating, but Torah, prayer, and acts of generosity. Those Jewish institutions that focus solely on the mechanics of self-perpetuation, no names here, I wouldn't want to embarrass anyone, but fail to actively engage Jews and their partners and friends in real Jewish prayer, study, and life-changing charity are not really valuable. They are moving us farther from where we need to be. For too long, we have followed the same models and pretended that our efforts will bring commitment and change. They don't, and they won't. only a significant redirection of Jewish talent and resources from institutional inertia and bureaucratic waste to truly support primary Jewish acts in synagogues and study centers. Torah, Avodah, Gmilut Chasadim, as Pirkei Avot teaches, study, prayer, and tzedakah will avert the severe decree, change our fate, and give us a good new year. May we all choose this course wisely and well in our community and in other communities all across the world. Slichot, the service that begins the High Holy Days season, is coming up this Saturday night. The late night prayers that begin a period of penitence and return are Yamim Noraim, the Jewish Days of Awe. We continue our pre-Rosh Hashanah preview of High Holy Day music with the beautiful and haunting Ki Kishimcha from the Rosh Hashanah morning service. We offer praise to you who waits for us to return. That was Ki Kishimcha from the Rosh Hashanah morning service, coming up 2 weeks from now. Our guest on Two Jewish This Morning founded a remarkable network of schools in Israel called Hand in Hand, in which Jewish and Arab children study and play together. Find out how and why he did it when we come back on Two Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, it's common knowledge that what's large to one person may appear small to another. Take pizza, for example. Some places sell a, quote, large pizza for a pretty large price. Then surprise, you get it home, it barely feeds three people. Some places sell you two large pizzas for the price of one. Believe me, they can't be too large unless they're using real cheap ingredients. But that's a subject for another commercial. Anyway, at Mama's, we think our family-sized pizza should be the yardstick for measuring all pizzas. In fact, you need a yardstick to measure it. The bottom line is that pizza size is all relative. And on behalf of all my relatives, we invite you to Mama's to try one of our pizzas, no matter what size. After all, every Mama's pizza has a taste that's huge. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. You can check them all out at mamasfamous.com. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Lee Gordon. He's the executive director of American Friends of Hand in Hand, the school, now school system, that he founded in Israel. Lived in Israel for more than 20 years, where he was actively involved in Jewish-Arab dialogue. Originally from the States, he got a master's in social work from Hebrew University and then graduated from the Mandel Institute's prestigious School for Educational Leadership. A veteran social activist and community organizer, he's now living in the States and helping to build support for Hand in Hand. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
All right. So tell us how Hand in Hand got started, Yab Yad, and what led to your decision to try to start this with your partner.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I lived in Israel for 20 years, and I was very active in the peace movement and in various projects and initiatives aimed at building dialogue and reconciliation between Palestinians and Israelis, and also inside of Israel, between Israeli Arab and Israeli Jewish citizens. But I found that many of these programs were very sort of superficial and non-continuous. People would get together in dialogue, but never really build ongoing partnerships and coexistence. And so, together with my co-founder, an Israeli Arab educator named Amin Khalaf, we focused on the school system as an avenue for helping to create a new model of quality education, but building an arena where Jews and Arabs could come together on a continual basis. 10 months a year, and then year after year, and then also through the children, you reach out to the parents and the wider community. And we entered a kind of a vacuum because, unfortunately, the Israeli school system is highly segregated. Jewish kids go to Jewish Hebrew-speaking schools, and Arab kids go to Arabic-speaking schools, and there's very little opportunity for mixed schools. In fact, when Hand in Hand was created, there was only one other example of a mixed school in a village called Neve Shalom. We decided that we wanted to build public schools because we wanted to make them accessible to families from all socioeconomic backgrounds. We also wanted to have an impact on the system, so to speak, to help reform education from within. And we were lucky to find a lot of open-minded professionals in the Israeli Ministry of Education who have been supporting us since the very beginning. We started in 1998. We opened a kindergarten class in Jerusalem and a first grade class in the Galilee in northern Israel. And then each year, as those kids have moved up a grade, new classes have entered, so that we now in Jerusalem just this past June graduated our second high school class, and many of those students started in kindergarten back in 1998 and 1999. And since these two schools were founded in 1998, we opened a third school in 2004 in the center of Israel in the Israeli Arab village of Kfar Kara. And then we helped establish a fourth school in Beersheba in the south of Israel, which is now autonomous and not run directly under the Hand in Hand auspices. And then finally, we are now working in two other major cities in Israel, in Haifa in the north and in Tel Aviv, working to build a kind of shared community of Jewish and Arab adults focused on the future establishment of new integrated schools there.
Wow, it's quite an institution, and I'll have to have you tell the story of when you started this project the first time when we come back a little later on Two Jewish, because it's just a fantastic story about building cooperation. But we'll do that when we come back on Two Jewish with Lee Gordon. Among my most pleasant and least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the total Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know anyone who might qualify for the 2012 Kohan Award, just visit our website, kohanaward.com, that's KOHANaward.com, and you can find the nomination form there. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's KOHANAWARD.com, KohanAward.com. It's a good visit and a great place to learn about a terrific award and all the recipients.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. That's T-O-O, jewishradio@yahoo. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. And here are our weekly 2012 presidential election campaign Jewish moments. The Republican convention in Tampa began improbably with an invocation from Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, the grandnephew of the great modern Orthodox icon Rabbi Joseph Ber Soloveitchik, the Rov, and himself the inheritor of the mantle of that great family, as well as being a prominent modern Orthodox rabbi himself. The 35-year-old Soloveitchik has ordination from Yeshiva University, a doctorate in philosophy from Princeton. He's rabbi at an important modern Orthodox synagogue in New York and supposedly a candidate for chief rabbi of Great Britain. Sadly, these impressive credentials led to a pretty pedestrian invocation from Rabbi Soloveitchik, to be honest. It was nice to hear this on national TV from the podium of the GOP's nominating convention, however.
You commanded Moses many years ago, Ukratem Doror Ba'aretz Lechol Yoshveha, proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. Today, this biblical verse is emblazoned on the Liberty Bell, which embodies American independence.
The rest of his prayer invoked God's blessing on Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan and emphasized that Judaism believed that blessings come from God, not government. On the other side of the rabbinic ledger, Rabbis for Obama was launched last week with 613 rabbis signing on, 613 commandments, about double what it had in the 2008 race, all proclaiming their support for President Obama for his record of accomplishments domestically and his support for Israel. The leaders of the group include Rabbi Sam Gordon of the Chicago area, who headed it in 2008 and is a skiing friend of mine, by the way, and our guest about 2 weeks ago from Two Jewish, Rabbi Bert Vysotsky of the Jewish Theological Seminary. There is no corresponding group of Rabbis for Romney, nor is there apparently any plan to launch a Priests for Obama, Ministers for Obama, Imams for Obama, or Gurus for Obama group. That was our campaign 2012 Jewish election moment. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. It's Labor Day weekend. Boker Tov.
Happy Labor Day. Boker Tov.
Thank you. I think for most Americans, Labor Day is a day off, but and it is, of course, a day off from labor, but it was originally founded by the American Labor Movement. The movement, American movement, labor movement became important in America, but boy, nothing like the Histadrut in Israel. Can you explain what the Histadrut was and maybe even is today in Israel?
I can try. It's a complex issue. The Histadrut today is not what it used to be in the past. In the past, the Histadrut was the main leading union in Israel. But when I'm saying leading union, there were times at the 50s, at the 60s, where I think in a rough estimation, you could say that about 90% of the workforce were members of the Histadrut.
90%.
90%, approximately, give or take. There were times in the 70s, for example, people wouldn't be able to find a job if they weren't members in the Histadrut. Now, there are pros and cons to that. Today, it's not the case. The Histadrut is still the biggest union, but it's definitely lost a lot of its power along the years. The pros and cons go both ways. On one hand, a strong union does represent the workers, the employees, and get them better social rights. And until today, the social rights in Israel are by far better than what you have in the United States. I'll give you a few examples. Vacation days. I'm not familiar what the law says in the US, and does the government even define a minimum number of vacation days? In Israel, you are obligated by law to give at least 10 days of vacation a year to any employee. And you need to also give them days of medical absence.
Plus, of course, the Jewish holidays are legal holidays, some of them anyway.
Of course. I don't even refer to the Jewish holidays as vacation days.
Right.
Okay, that's separate. If you count those, then you probably end up with over 20 or 23 days a year,
because right,
combining together.
But who's counting?
But who's counting? Exactly. So those are things that historically the Histadrut was able to get for the workers. Another example would be the process of firing an employee. In many places in Israel today, it's the common practice that you need to give an employee a 30-day head notice before you fire them. That's also historically an achievement that the Histadrut was able to bring into the table in negotiations. Here in the United States, you can fire an employee from now to now. Now, if you are the owner, you'd say, well, I want to run my business. I want to be able to control whatever I do. But if you do the switch and look at it from the eyes of the employee, having a 30-day notice gives you the opportunity to look for another job, to build your life, to look at your savings, to prepare for a very challenging situation. So from a social justice perspective, it's probably much more moral to give someone a notice and not just come to their desk and say, okay, you're out of here.
It's a great beginning introduction. Histadrut, of course, the huge labor union, and also controlled Israeli politics for a long time. Let's pick it up next week, and you can give us a little bit more of an idea of where Histadrut is today. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
Everything you always wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 13th anniversary year with a brand new family class and in a new location. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn now. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Jason Holtz lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up. Taste of Judaism is a tremendously successful education and outreach program and an exciting learning opportunity for anyone who is simply curious about Judaism or who wants to deepen their knowledge and gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The classes include delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. The sessions are free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But you do need to pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. This year, Taste of Judaism is offering both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class with rabbis, while kids have their own Taste of Judaism children's program with Jewish stories, crafts, and activities. With excellent THA teachers, it's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There is no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Anderson at 520-327-4501 for more information and register today.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, we were talking last week about Eastern Europeans in the United States, in this case, some that were working for Camp Ramah, and you had a fascinating story that involved the Masons.
Right. So you might want to explain to your listeners who the Masons are and what their history is. But I will say that one of the things that was
The Masons are not Jews, although there certainly have been Jewish Masons somewhere along the way, but an ancient order of people that were Labor Day this weekend. It was kind of a trade professional organization, but had all kinds of secret rites and rituals, and were often suspected of plotting against somebody or other, although really never kind of worked like that. George Washington was a Mason. A lot of people who were surveyors in the early days of the United States were Masons.
Right. I think in the old world, there was a lot of suspicion that they were anti-government or some kind of cult just because they surrounded themselves with secrecy.
Right.
Whereas here, they
aprons
tend to be seen more like the Rotary Club or the Lions Club
Kiwanis,
or Kiwanis, whatever. Right. It's a social club.
The Lions.
And not as some threat to the American way
right.
of life.
It's just a Masonic lodge. You go there for your meetings. Right.
So what was interesting was sitting with these very highly educated people from Ukraine, Russia, Poland, whatever. The first and most burning question they had was, we were in town the other day and we saw a public sign for Masons meetings. Why do you allow that in this country? Aren't you afraid of it? Don't you realize what a threat it represents? And I couldn't believe my ears. I mean, I thought they were joking until I saw from their faces that they were deadly serious. And then I realized that the reason that people in these countries have traditionally been so susceptible to things like the blood libel about Jews or other types of patently absurd stories about the unknown or the other or the stranger is that information was always closely guarded by governments, by tradition in all of these countries. There was little, if any, freedom of the press.
And before that, by the church.
Right. There was a very low rate of literacy in the population as a whole, particularly in rural areas. So that today, even though these were highly educated people who were all at least bilingual and very impressive by and large, they still widely shared beliefs like this, very sort of primitive, superstitious beliefs about anything that was other, with a capital O. And it was a little scary, but it was also very revealing.
You know, it's fascinating. We tend to think that education will open up everybody's eyes and eliminate prejudices, but, you know, there were lots of extremely well-educated Nazis, too. So it's not that simple.
Right.
We will talk next week, Tom, and hopefully continue to enlighten the world and move us from prejudice towards acceptance and understanding.
From your lips to God's ears.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A Reform rabbi was such a compulsive golfer that once, on Yom Kippur morning, he left the house early and went out for a quick 9 holes. An angel who happened to be looking on immediately notified his superiors that a grievous sin was being committed on the Day of Atonement. On the sixth hole, God caused a mighty wind to take the rabbi's ball directly from the tee to the cup. A miraculous shot, a hole in one. The angel was horrified. "A hole in one," he exclaimed. "You call this punishment, Lord?" And God answered with a sly smile, "So, who's he going to tell?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish Just for You. You should live and be well, and don't go golfing on Yom Kippur. And now a word of Torah. The great labor Zionist thinker Ahad Ha'am taught that Judaism is made up of three great elements: God, Torah, and Israel. So what are we to make of a central Jewish text that completely omits one of these three? This week we read the Torah portion of Ki Tavo in Deuteronomy, which begins with an unusual declaration. When we come into the land that the Lord our God will give us as an inheritance, we are to take the first fruits of our produce and bring them to the priests and say this: Arami Oved Avi, my father was a wandering Aramean. He came to Egypt few in number, became a great nation there. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and enslaved us, but God brought us out with a great hand and an outstretched arm, brought us to this place, flowing with milk and honey. In addition to its central role in this important biblical ritual, the passage was quoted often in rabbinic literature, most famously in the Pesach Haggadah, used at the Passover Seder. But the formula for what we're supposed to say when we bring this first fruits offering to the tabernacle is surprising. In its mini history of our ancient people, it includes two of the enormous elements of our people's history: Yetziat Mitzrayim, the exodus from Egypt, and the entry into and settlement of the land of Israel. But it curiously omits all mention of a third, equally crucial event, the giving of Torah at Sinai. It's a fascinating, maybe shocking omission. If the three most important elements of Jewish identity are God, Torah, and Israel, omitting Torah means having an incomplete form of Judaism. Ironically, here in the Torah itself, what's missing is, well, Torah. One explanation for this Ki Tavo omission teaches us much about how religion evolves and what an organic and remarkable creation Judaism really is. In biblical times, our people constituted an agricultural nation, living on and with the land. The most important religious experiences were farming-related: planting crops, harvesting, dividing produce, offering it, eating it. The connection to the land itself and the labor needed to produce food from it was absolutely central to our identity. Eretz Yisrael truly was the holy land of Israel, and our intimate and permanent relationship to that land was forged over centuries of daily labor and life. When Zionism reconnected Jews to our land in the 19th century in a real, tangible, practical way, it revived the whole experience of loving and serving God by creating food from the very earth. Hamotzi lechem min haaretz, we say in Hebrew. The land of Israel was at the heart of our people then, and it's at the heart of our Torah portion, as we hope it's at the heart of every Jew in the world. Like Eretz Yisrael, God too was central to Jewish life in the times of the Bible, as it is today. In our portion, Ki Tavo, we're commanded to bring this offering to God in the tabernacle and later the temple, to thank God for all that we have. And we are to remember the great gift of freedom that God conferred upon us by miraculously redeeming us from Egyptian slavery. Everything comes from God. A good lesson today, as in the time of Deuteronomy. So, God and Israel, but not Torah. Clearly, the third leg of this stool of Jewish identity was far less crucial to our ancestors than the other two. Again, why? As farmers in our own land, the need to study Torah in whatever form it took must have seemed less urgent. We had an immediate relationship with the land, and we needed God for the basics that make agriculture possible: rain, sun, soil. The importance of Torah was diminished when we lived on the land. But when we were sent into exile and forcibly torn from Israel, we needed Torah. In fact, without the study of Torah, Judaism would have disappeared and the people of Israel faded into the dust of history. Only Torah preserved us, gave us the moral founding and the religious identity to not only survive, but thrive. When we read in Ki Tavo, in the Torah, of course, that we are to give a tenth of all that we have earned to charity, to the poor and homeless and widow and orphan, we acknowledge that we have been blessed. We're following an ancient agricultural practice, yes, more than 3,000 years old, designed for an ancient people in a land of long ago, but we are also using this remarkable Torah, this great text, to teach us how to live now. And therein lies the true genius of Judaism. For wherever we are in the world, it's the Torah that binds us together and makes possible our unity as a people. It is Torah that reminds us to worship God and of our connection to the Holy Land of Israel. It is the Torah that teaches us that tzedakah must be part and parcel of our very being. Paradoxically, even when the Torah seems to be absent, as it is in Ki Tavo, it is not only implicitly present, but actually central in our religion and in our lives. May it always be so for each one of us. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, Lee Gordon, will explain how Jews and Arabs can get along, in Israel, no less. Stay with us on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Everything you always wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 13th anniversary year with a brand new family class and in a new location. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn now. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Jason Holtz lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up. Taste of Judaism is a tremendously successful education and outreach program and an exciting learning opportunity for anyone who is simply curious about Judaism or who wants to deepen their knowledge and gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The classes include delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. The sessions are free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But you do need to pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. This year, Taste of Judaism is offering both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class with rabbis, while kids have their own Taste of Judaism children's program with Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There is no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Anderson at 520-327-4501 for more information and register today.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a horrible story, a violent anti-Semitic hate crime took place early last Sunday in East Lansing, Michigan. 19-year-old Zachary Tenen was beaten unconscious and then had his mouth stapled by two men. Tenen, a sophomore at Michigan State, was approached by the men at a party who asked if he was Jewish. They proceeded to raise their right arms in a Nazi salute, said Heil Hitler, and beat Tenen unconscious. According to his mother, 20 people watched while her son had his mouth stapled by the two suspects. It's an awful hate crime, but what he's gone through emotionally and physically is scary, to put it into words, Tina Tenen said. Hopefully the worst is behind us. Following the attack, Tenen took a cab to a nearby hospital and would eventually receive surgery to have his jaw wired shut in Detroit. I hope they get prosecuted and go to jail, Tina Tenen said. You hear about it in the news, but I guess it's something you think will never happen to you. With 20 witnesses, they should be able to find these guys. Michigan State has approximately 3,000 Jewish undergraduates, according to Hillel. Tenen's mother said her family has spoken with the school and they've been responsive. The school's been in touch with them. They've reached out to us, but we're still trying to find the attackers. The job isn't done. In other unhappy and colorful news, an Egyptian political science professor told an Iranian TV station that with Allah's help, Israel will be annihilated by 2013. In an interview with Iran's state-run Arabic news channel Al-Alam, Professor Gamal Zahran last week, head of the political science department at Egypt's Port Said University and a former independent member of parliament there, said, Jerusalem is at the heart of the Palestinian cause, and the Palestinian cause is the cause of all Arabs and Muslims. The elimination of the Zionist entity is beyond debate. The only question has to do with the circumstances. He went on, we are constantly keeping the memory alive among the younger generations so that they will realize that the Palestinian cause is an essential one. The hope and the memory will later turn into action by next year, Allah willing. Israel will be annihilated. It won't. But perhaps Egypt will completely implode, as it has been threatening to do ever since the Arab winter and spring 2 years ago. Anyway, in spite of this prediction, in July, Israel experienced a record tourism month, which means that every single month this year has been a record month for tourism in Israel. Wow. And tourist visitors to one historical park in northern Israel are now free to surf the web as long as they sit on their asses. No, you heard that correct. Donkeys, widely mentioned in the Bible as popular modes of transportation, are being used in a 21st century way at Kfar Kedem Park. They carry Wi-Fi routers around their necks. The site's name translates, ironically, to Village of Yore, or Old Time Town. Our village has 30 donkeys, and we've equipped the first five with wireless routers that are attached to the donkey's body, the park's founder, Menachem Goldberg, said. In the future, we'll consider equipping all the donkeys with the necessary Wi-Fi apparatuses. Goldberg said the tourists to the site, which invites them to dress in traditional clothes and experience ancient Galilean life, enjoy sharing their experiences online. If you take some pictures, you want to change your picture on Facebook, at Kfar Kedem, you can do it, Goldberg said. This donkey has been used as a working animal for 5,000 years, Goldberg added, reading from a Wikipedia page on his iPad as he sat on a donkey. There are more than 40 million donkeys in the world. That's a lot of donkeys and apparently a lot of Wi-Fi connections if you're in Israel. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Lee Gordon. He's the executive director of American Friends of Hand in Hand and a co-founder of Hand in Hand, the Center for Jewish Arab Education in Israel, which works to build peace, coexistence, and equality through a network of integrated bilingual schools, that's Hebrew and Arabic, for Jewish and Arab children. Founded back in 1997, it has reached well beyond the original first school. But Lee, can you tell us a little bit about how you and Amin first began the school and what that first night was like?
Sure. Well, first of all, you know, we weren't really sure whether we were just some crazy dreamers and you know, dreaming some unrealistic dream that would never really take place. And we knew we were a bit crazy, but we wanted to find out, was there enough viability in this idea to really get started? So we spent a lot of time in the fall of 1997 meeting with Arab and Jewish educators, small town mayors, funders, people like that, just to sort of get the sense, are we crazy and naive, or is this something that really we should go for? And the basic message we got back and the feedback we got back from these people was, one, we are crazy, but two, it's a wonderful idea and you should really go for it. And I think we were empowered enough by this feedback from people that we decided we were going to push forward. And we spent the better part of the next few months searching for locales to house our schools. We knew we wanted to start one in Jerusalem where we lived, but we wanted to start a second school because we thought if one school really falters and falls along the way, we don't want to start from scratch. We want to at least have a backup plan. So we focused on an area in the Galilee called Misgav, which is in the central Galilee, which is northern Israel. It's an area where actually Arabs outnumber Jews. There are many Arab towns and villages, and they're usually adjacent to Jewish towns and villages. And there's not, unfortunately, a whole lot of interaction between these communities, and we thought this would be an ideal place to do a school. So we had arranged to, it was February, and we arranged to have an open meeting in which we had invited several hundred parents, Jewish and Arab parents, who had kids of elementary school age, mostly kids who were going to be entering preschool, kindergarten, first grade. And we decided to have this first meeting in an Arab village up there in the north because we wanted to see whether Jewish parents would be willing to go out in the evening to an Arab village. And we had arranged to have two young actresses, one Arab, one Jewish, who do a kind of bilingual theater. We had arranged to have mayors come. And we spent a fair amount of money sort of getting this meeting put together. It turned out that this meeting was, it was a stormy day, and this sounds almost like a cliche, but it was a
dark and stormy night.
It was a stormy night. There was a lot of rain, and there was thunder. The meeting was scheduled to begin at 8:30 in the sort of public meeting room in the small city hall of this village called Kaukab, an Arab village in the Misgav area of northern Israel. At 8:35, there were seven people in the room, and I remember this very distinctly. And I was already, you know, being the sort of the eternal optimist I was saying, well, this is a stormy night, people aren't going to come out, we'll have to come back in 3 weeks and do another meeting. At 5 minutes before nine, there were 150 people crowded into this room. Many of them were standing in this sort of hallway because there was not enough room to sit. The meeting continued at 11 o'clock, over 2 hours into the meeting. There was a very heated discussion about the pros and cons of this, about what it means to be a Jew in this region, and what it means to know your Arab neighbors, to not know your Arab. I mean, it was a really wonderful but heated discussion. One of the mayors, the Jewish mayor of the Misgav Regional Council, a man named Erez Kreisler, he got up and he said, you know, for the past 2 hours, a group of Jewish and Arab adults have been sitting, having a heated but civil discussion. And he said, this is a very rare occurrence in Israel. And that in and of itself is a huge accomplishment. Let's take the energy that's been created in this room and make this idea of building a bilingual integrated school into a reality. And I kind of, it was an aha moment. I knew that we'd passed this certain threshold. And I knew that we were going to have a school in the Galilee. We didn't have a single parent registered for the school. We didn't have a location for the school. We hadn't hired teachers. We didn't have enough funding. But I knew that we'd passed this certain hurdle. And there were many other hurdles, but it was kind of a wonderful moment for me because it sort of, I mean, I remember this very, it was, you know, that was 14 years ago almost, but I remember it very, very vividly. And I'm not going to say it's all been downhill since. There's been lots and lots of things to climb. But we went ahead, and that school in northern Israel opened on September 1st of 1998. And the other moment, which, you know, it's a very small, you know, thing that maybe in this country people would take for granted, where there's lots and lots of integrated schools where black Americans and white Americans and Hispanic Americans go to school together. But on the first day of school, my colleague Amin and I decided to spend that day in the Galilee. And we spent the whole day just kind of trying to stay out of the teacher's hair, but wanting to be in the class with the kids. And at the end of the day, one of the things the kids all learned how to do was to write their name in Hebrew and Arabic. And I remember seeing several of these kids come out with this grin on their faces, showing their parents this, how they wrote their name in both languages. And it was such a, for me personally, a very moving experience because it was kind of a microcosm of what we were trying to do. And, you know, since then, many of these kids have gone on to become fluent in both Hebrew and Arabic and then fluent in English as well. And we've had, you know, a number of generations now of elementary school graduates of that school. But, you know, the conflict in Israel between Jews and Arabs is filled with symbols, and you know, unfortunately, the symbols take on meanings beyond what they really need to do. I mean, you know, the Israeli flag has the Star of David in it, which is, you know, it's a proud symbol for Jews. For many Arabs in Israel, it's a symbol of feeling like they're second-class citizens. the Arabic language is you know, Arabs take pride in it, but many Jews hear Arabic and they're afraid. They associate it with their enemy, and so we're trying to kind of create something new to hold on to these symbols, but to show people that they're symbols that don't necessarily have to divide people, but that can bring people together, but also to create new symbols and of you know, coexistence, of partnership, of universal kind of thinking. You know, it's clear to us that you know, just by virtue of having kids go to integrated schools in Israel and learn each other's languages, peace is not going to break out tomorrow. But we're also quite certain that without schools like ours and many other projects that bring people together, there also won't be peace. So we're kind of part of that mosaic that is not going to be complete until you have all those pieces in it. And we're one big piece of that mosaic, but we're only part of it, if that makes sense.
It does. Here's the question. You guys now have several schools going. I mean, is there a desire to create a larger comprehensive network that would at some point really have a much larger percentage of Israeli kids integrating in this way?
Definitely. I mean, I think that we are still, you know, more like a boutique model of small schools. We have 1,000 students, and you can look at the Israeli school system and say there are about 1.6 million school children in Israel, and we're 1,000, we're a drop in the bucket. How do you hope to have any kind of impact?
Right.
So one, we do want to grow. We are not naive, and we do not believe that it's realistic that the majority of Israeli students are going to be immersed in schools like ours. I mean, partly because Arabs and Jews are not always living geographically close together. We do believe that we can have 10, 12, 15 schools like ours and have quite a few more thousand students. But we also think that our schools are, it's not just a question of numbers, it's also a question of being models that wider society can see. So that, you know, just one example might exemplify this, that we now have groups of parents in numerous towns and communities in Israel, in the city of Akko, in Haifa, in Tel Aviv, as I mentioned, in Upper Nazareth, who have come to us saying, we've heard about your schools, we've visited your schools, can you help us build a program like this in our community? And the second thing also is that we feel that our schools, it's not just about the work going on in the classroom, it's about gathering adults, parents, and even other adults who are not directly connected to the schools to come together and create shared communities of activity, whether it's social, cultural, recreational, economic joint programs. We would ideally love to see a program where we have between 5 and 10,000 students, and then three times that many other adults, non-students, Jewish and Arab, you know, citizens of Israel, joining together for programs. But I think that we will still be a minority model in Israel, but an important one.
I want to thank Lee Gordon for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His organization is American Friends of Hand in Hand. Where can people go to find out more information?
They can go to our website, which is www.handinhandk12.org. So that's handinhandk12.org. And if anybody needs to email, they can email us at info@handinhandk12.org. There's some wonderful in-depth articles, and there's some research, there's some videos, there's a lot of information about the schools. And I also want to just mention that if there are any of your listeners who are planning visits to Israel, we welcome visitors at our school with some advance notice, and they can contact us through our website to arrange a visit. If they're very inspiring, very informational and educational, and I think people come away feeling much more optimistic about the prospects for resolving the conflict inside of Israel and even outside of Israel, too.
We will look forward to visiting you when we come to Israel. Thanks very much, Lee, and a Shana Tova.
Shana Tova. Thank you, Rabbi Cohen. Good luck.
Thank you. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Daniel Wise, the producer of a new Broadway show on the life of the great rabbi, musician, and charismatic figure Shlomo Carlebach. The show is called Soul Doctor. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from our High Holy Day preview of music for the coming Days of Awe. It's a kind of theme song of the High Holy Days, B'Sefer Chaim. God, write us in the Book of Life in the coming year. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.